This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Live and Learn. I'm Troy Antik. Women and men do not have equal rights when seeking citizenship for their children or foreign spouses. What are the implications of nationality laws that discriminates on the basis of gender? In the studio to explain are Shamila Sekran from Voice of the Children and Amal Dichigara from the Institute of Statelessness and Inclusion. Both were delegates at the National Consultation on Achieving Equal Nationality Rights for Women and Men last week. Shamila, Amal, welcome. Just to begin, Shamila, if I can start with you. This is not a new issue. It's been long running, decades long even. How did this movement or consultation came to be, and how long did it take to organize it to get to where we were last week?
So, hi, yes. Thank you, Antek. So this national consultation was really specifically on gender inequality in our national law with regards to the conferment of citizenship. And as you're absolutely right, it's decades. It's been going on for far too long. Many people have suffered because of it or are left in a kind of citizenship limbo because of it. And so this particular national consultation was formed by the Foreign Spouses Support Group. And it's a group which has been in existence for a couple of years now. And they're the ones who are most affected, really, them and their children. And they approached a few other organizations, JAG, the Joint Action Group of Women NGOs, Empower, people like that have all come together to support this initiative. And Voice of the Children has also been present during the entire process of the consultation to put forward the child perspective on the how they are affected in terms of the unequal nationality laws.
Right. We'll get to the child's perspective. Amal, you're from the Institute of Statelessness and Inclusion. What is your input from the global perspective on this consultation? What is the objective of your presence at the consultation?
Thank you. In addition to being from the Institute on Statelessness and Inclusion, I'm also a steering committee member of the Global Campaign on Equal Nationality Rights. And it's a global campaign that initially came in with the Malaysian partners that Shamila spoke of to offer its expertise and the comparative experience from different countries around the world, some of which have successfully advocated on this issue and effected change, and others which are still in the process of doing so. And so I came in along with my colleague Catherine Harrington from the Global Campaign to offer that international perspective and to offer support to the wonderful actors in Malaysia who have been taking this issue forward and fighting the cause over many years.
Mm-hmm. Shamila, so just two questions here. Why were gender bias or discrimination written into these laws on the conferment of citizenships? And what can we do about it? So I guess we'll start with the first one. Was there a reason? Was it by design, or is this an unintended consequence of what lawmakers did not think of?
Sure. So I think really to start with, it is a little bit perhaps of a colonial legacy that we're left with. But historically, women have never been seen as equal partners to men. And this is something that has been going on for a long time. So putting women on the same level, on par as men, having the same rights as men, is something which the women's groups have been advocating for, fighting for many, many years, for generations in many cases. I do not represent the women groups at all, but I know this for a fact, that there has been a very patriarchal approach to handling women and girls. So you're always appendage of a man. You're either someone's husband, someone's daughter, or someone's wife, or mother, sorry. I said husband, I meant mother. Sorry, you're someone's daughter, someone's wife, or someone's mother. So it's only in more recent times, with a lot of lobbying, a lot of education, a lot of advocacy, that the rights of women are being listened to and are being advocated on. And that's where we're seeing the change. So it was, I think it was in the 2002 amendment, constitutional amendment, that gender was inserted into Article 8 of the Federal Constitution. Article 8 of the Federal Constitution being the article on equality, the fact that every person is equal before the law and has equal treatment of the law. And then it goes on to specify categories. So, for example, no discrimination based on race. And it was inserted that there shall be no discrimination based on gender. But unfortunately, many laws... So the natural progression then would be to look at all laws and to synchronize those laws in line with the Constitution so that you remove gender inequality from other constitutional provisions as well as other laws. Mm. And, well, I think it's political will because there's no other explanation as to why it didn't happen.
Mm-hmm. So the federal constitution should be the supreme law of the land, isn't it? All these provisions, shouldn't they be read next to what the federal constitution say? And so if there is this prohibiting discrimination based on gender, what is the issue now?
So you're absolutely right. So one of the problems with citizenship, the granting of citizenship or conferring of citizenship, is that we don't have a separate citizenship law. So we obtain citizenship via the Constitution, specifically Article 14, 15 and the schedules related thereto. And those articles, like I said, 14 and 15, appear to have discrimination written into it. But, you know, this is something that came out of the consultation, that in reality, if we had the right way of reading a constitution and interpreting the constitution, then you're absolutely right. Even then, there is less of a problem. For example, we were discussing that there is an article, for example, that says a father can confer citizenship to the child, but it's silent on the right of a mother. So you're at what you were saying, Antek, just now, that you then read that article in line with Article 8. And so you confer citizenship on the mother by virtue of Article 8 read together with Article 15.
Right.
But that's not what's happening. It's not happening in the courts, because we do not read the Constitution purposively and we do not read it generously. We do not read it in line with the fundamental liberty provision and essentially what the Constitution was meant to embody,
right,
the rights that they were supposed to protect.
Amal, is this something that is common around the world that is happening too, or is Malaysia unique in not having a standalone citizenship law?
It's increasing. It's increasingly uncommon to have countries that discriminate on the basis of gender when it comes to nationality. So if you look at the kind of overwhelming consensus in the world over the last, since the turn of the century, for example, almost 20 countries have amended their laws in a very positive way. And we now are in a situation where there are still 25 countries which deny women equal rights to pass their nationality on to their children, 3 countries which deny men equal rights to pass their nationality to their children, and around 50 countries which have discriminatory provisions in terms of conferring nationality onto your spouse. And Malaysia is one of the few countries which is in all 3 of these categories. So it is a matter of concern. Just to go back on to go back to what Shamila said as well, if you look at all of these countries in which you have these kinds of discriminatory provisions, they tend to be the legal frameworks and systems and principles that were inherited from colonial times. And we now live in a post-colonial world in which international standards and national standards in most countries have gone far beyond. But in a few countries, we are still left with this situation where there's a gap between internal provisions of constitutions, as Shamila said, but also a gap between the commitments that countries have made in terms of their international obligations and how we see the law actually being implemented on the ground. So I think the time really is ripe, and we will speak in a moment, I think, about some of the recommendations and conclusions that came out of this consultation. But when we do so, you will see that there's a lot that can be done without even amending the law, but still to make Malaysia's law a model law in terms of eradicating gender discrimination, it would also be necessary to have some legal amendments in place.
Mm-hmm. Sharmila, as Amal said, one of 25 countries globally that denies citizens the right to confer nationality on their children due to their gender. So the nationality of the child, citizenship of the child, has to follow the mother. Why is that not good enough?
So actually, it's both ways. So, for example, if you have a child born to a Malaysian mother overseas, outside Malaysia, the mother cannot confer to a foreign spouse. Sorry. So let me make that very clear. A child born to a Malaysian mother and a foreign spouse born outside Malaysia, that child cannot follow the citizenship of the mother. The child is expected to follow the citizenship of the father. This is not by constitutional provision, but more by policy and the way it's being carried out. A child born to a Malaysian father and a foreign mother in Malaysia, but born out of wedlock, cannot obtain the citizenship of the father. So a Malaysian man who has a child out of wedlock cannot give his citizenship to his child. Mm-hmm. And we see many, many, many cases where a child is born out of wedlock to a couple. The couple subsequently get married. They remain married for many, many years. We're talking about some even 20 years now, and the children are grown up. This child subsequently has siblings who are born within the marriage. So those siblings have Malaysian citizenship, and the eldest child who was born out of wedlock remains of indeterminate status. Mm-hmm. The other issue that we have to grapple with also is the fact that the view that we seem to take is that you automatically follow the citizenship of the mother. But we have to recognize that not all countries have the same citizenship laws. So if you take Syria as an example, a Syrian mother cannot confer citizenship to a child. You have to follow the father's citizenship. So if you have a situation where you have a Malaysian man and a Syrian woman, and the child is born out of wedlock, you're denying the man the right to give the child citizenship. The mother, by operation of Syrian law, cannot give her child citizenship. Where does this child fit in? What state does this child belong to? Mm-hmm. What citizenship does this child have? Mm-hmm. And then you have the problem of statelessness. Mm-hmm. And that is a fundamental problem because we're having increasing numbers of children who are falling into statelessness, who are stateless or falling to a state of statelessness because of the operation of our law, the way we carry it out and execute it, rather than what the hard law says, the letter of the law says.
Right. Can I come in on that? Yeah. So there, if unpacking that a little further, I think what we end up with is two very basic legal principles. The one is that there should not be discrimination on the basis of gender. And the other is that every child has the right to a nationality. And if we look at this from these two perspectives, so first from the gender discrimination perspective, we see that what happens, the way these laws have been drafted and are now interpreted and implemented, is that there is this patriarchal mindset and attitude which determines certain gender roles to women and men. So it's interesting that if it's a child born out of wedlock, it's the father who cannot pass on nationality. Because the other assumption probably is that the role of bringing up a child as a single parent lies with the mother. Mm-hmm. Whereas if it's a child born within wedlock, it's the mother who generally is denied the right. And there the understanding is that the child's identity comes from the father. So these go back to very ancient and completely unjustifiable perspectives and positions in terms of the role that gender plays. And then when we look at it from a child rights perspective, and Sharmila can speak to this much more powerfully than I can, But there we see a situation of a child being penalized for the actions or inactions of the state, of state actors, of laws, of their parents. Mm-hmm. And this completely undermines very basic principles such as the state has to always act in the best interests of the child, and the child has a right to an identity and a nationality. So whether you approach it from a gender discrimination perspective or a child rights perspective, we still come to the same conclusion that with some very simple tweaks to the law, you can end up with a legal framework that works for everyone and that doesn't leave families under immense strain and doesn't leave children with very few prospects in terms of their future.
If we were to look at through your the first point you make, which is where discrimination on the basis of gender is disallowed, implication of it is it that there has to be dual nationality allowed? Because if there's a parents of two nationalities, the child would either have to choose or be allowed both nationalities.
Yeah, so I mean, I think the dual nationality question is a separate one, and it's workable to prohibit dual nationality for whatever other considerations the state may have, but still allow entitle both parents equality in terms of conferral of nationality. So the way that normally works is the child has to decide upon achieving the age of majority. Yeah. So when you turn 18, you need to decide whether you want your mother's or your father's nationality. And there are many countries around the world which prohibit dual nationality, which do employ this as a very reasonable kind of method to eradicate discrimination and ensure that the child grows up in a safe environment, whether it's in their mother's country or their father's country.
I'm speaking today to Shamila Sekran and Amal Dichigara about unequal nationality rights. We'll come back and address this issue from the child's perspective after this break. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. You're listening to Live and Learn. I'm Troy Antic. My guests today are Shamila Sekran from Voice of the Children and Amal Dichigara from the Institute of Statelessness and Inclusion. We're discussing nationality laws which discriminates on the basis of gender. Shamila, taking the child's rights perspective, does Malaysia, the judiciary or the executive, have an answer to this statelessness limbo that we put children in this, who are facing this predicament?
They should have an answer. I don't know if they do. But the answer is actually very simple. And really, the answer does not need not much legislative reform. It can be done, one, through, as you said, through court proceedings, and certainly through administrative and policy change. So, like we were talking about, I mean, you know, we've got the five statelessness cases coming up on the 30th of August, so that would test our legal principles on this issue. But like we've been saying earlier, the laws are not bad. They could be better. They could be strengthened. They should be strengthened since we are talking about it and we've got this movement now. We need to amend them. But even if we did not, there are things that this government can do to address this issue. And really, a lot of it requires political will. A lot of it requires the right mindset. And that is where the change needs to happen. Like Amal said, we need to prioritize children. We need to act in the best interest of a child. We need to ensure, unfortunately, Malaysia has reserved Article 7 of the CRC, which is the child's right to identity. So we're giving children birth registrations, but we're not giving them nationality, and we're not concerned as to whether a child has nationality or not. And that is something that we should be looking at. It's well and good if we can show, or a child can show, that he or she has nationality of another country, then that's fine. So in a situation, we have many cases where expatriates, both parents are expatriates, they're living and working in Malaysia, and the children are born in Malaysia, but they take on the nationality of their parents. They don't apply for Malaysian nationality. They do not require it. They register their birth through their embassy or in their home country, in whatever process and mechanism set out for them. And we're not concerned about those children then, mm-hmm. you know, but we're concerned about the children who, by our operation of law and by our operation of policy and guidelines, we deny children nationality. That is what we're concerned about. And the whole purpose of this consultation was to highlight and bring to light, throw the light upon the fact that gender inequality, gender unequal laws do impact on citizens and their children in a very drastic way. We also cause families to be broken up when we do this. We cause children to be put into a situation where they're at risk of violation, at risk of being in an unprotected situation. When children are denied healthcare, when they're denied education, we actually put their society at risk as well. Mm-hmm. So these are the issues we really need to start looking at and thinking about.
And Amal, based on the work that you do, why are governments or countries not doing more? What are they afraid of? What are the arguments against, you know, the points that you put forth, gender equality as well as a focus on the child perspective?
That's a very good question. I think the first point I should make in answering that is that actually a lot of governments are doing a lot. As I mentioned, 19 countries have changed their laws in the last, since the turn of the century.
Including Indonesia.
Including Indonesia. I mean, Malaysia is now alone with Brunei in terms of ASEAN countries that still maintain gender discriminatory nationality laws. I think it's very important when we talk about the law to reflect on what the purpose of a particular law is. I mean, laws are made by people in order to bring about some social good or to bring about some social order or to bring about some benefits to society at large. And it's important to ask the question in this context, what benefit does society derive from a situation in which 50% of the population is basically given the message that their citizenship is not equal to that of 50%. And the children of certain parents in unfortunate situations don't have access to the basic rights that they should be entitled to as a child. And it's very difficult to, when you rationally think it through, to actually identify what this social good may be and that's worth paying this price for. If you look at the arguments that states make, they tend to fall into a few categories. So there tends to be concern about immigration and people who should not benefit from nationality and all of the goods that come out of nationality using marriage as a vehicle through which to get nationality. In some countries, there are questions around national security, and this applies mainly in the Middle East, where there are concerns again that foreigners marrying the women of the country and coming in can result in a national security threat. But when you look at all of these concerns, it's very intriguing that the solution to a problem is one of discrimination. Because if your real concern is immigration, then why are you only discriminating against women? If your real concern is national security, why are you only discriminating against women? And I'm not saying this in order to argue that what we need is a lowering of the bar all around, but simply to make the point that there are other very effective ways in which states can address any concerns that may be legitimate. But it requires a level of introspection in terms of where did these laws come from? Are they influenced by something deeper in terms of patriarchy or xenophobia or racial stereotypes? And if so, is this the type of a state that you want to construct and live in? Or do you want to try and collectively create something that aspires to be something better? Mm-hmm. So I think it's important to try and strip things down and recognize that this is an opportunity to create a society and a community that works better for all people.
Right. Sharmila, you alluded to the upcoming case on August 30th. The Chief Justice said from now onwards, constitutional matters of public interest would be heard by a full bench, all nine judges. Yeah. What will be at stake here? A lot of what Amal mentioned are the questions that will be posed to the judges. But if you could spell it out for us, what will be at stake during August 30th?
Effectively, all the applicants are children. They are children who do not have citizenship anywhere else. They're children who are born in Malaysia. Their path to ending up in federal court has been slightly different for the five different cases. But ultimately, these are the common issues. And fundamentally, one of the questions that we are asking, and I say we, meaning Voice of the Children, is asking, is the burden that has been imposed on a child to prove that he or she does not possess citizenship anywhere else. The presumption, like I said, the presumption has always been that because we presume that a child born out of wedlock shall have the mother's citizenship, we presume that other countries have the same law. That is not necessarily always the case. And the other factor is that what we then do or have been doing is we've been asking children to prove the fact that they do not have citizenship somewhere else before we're willing to confer citizenship upon them. This is a very onerous task for a child or even for a guardian of the child. Many of these cases are people of very low income groups. They do not have the means or the method of obtaining this information. Effectively, what we're asking them to do is to write to, 193 countries in the world, the governments of 193 countries, and ask them, can you confirm whether or not I have citizenship with you? This is something which a government can very easily resolve. It's a G2G issue. Our government can write to a local embassy, the embassy of the various countries, or the nearest embassy and obtain this information. We can do so through the UN. So to put this kind of burden on a child and the child's family is totally against the best interest of the child. It totally flies in the face of our commitment to protect children and to ensure the well-being of children. Mm-hmm. Fundamentally, these are the common issues that will be decided in these cases. We're really, really hoping that the judges will apply their minds to, as Amal was talking about, to the wider issue at stake. And Malaysia's obligation to its citizens and Malaysia's obligation and commitment to the international community by having ratified CEDAW, the Convention Against All Women, and the CRC, Convention on Rights of the Child. Mm-hmm. Although we have reservations in terms of two articles, 19.2 and in CEDAW and Article 7 in CRC, the fact is that we have made an international commitment, and a lot of these articles can and should be read in line with the other articles, pretty much like what we were talking about the Federal Constitution, reading Article 14 and 15 in line with, and the schedules thereto, in line with Article 8. So we're really hoping that the judges will apply their minds to these issues and will get a favourable outcome. But I think also what we need to establish is that these cases should not be cases, standalone cases. These cases should form the policy of how this government is going to implement the law moving forward. What we find very often from cases that are filed in court is that depending on the outcome, and if, for example, the outcome is such that the plaintiff or appellant has to be granted citizenship, then it's done for that person alone. And you've got many other very, very similar cases, almost identical cases. But they too have to go through the lengthy court process and the expensive process of filing a suit and getting a judgment in their favour before something is done administratively. So we're really hoping that this will set the tone of how the government is going to start implementing and thinking about citizenship and gender equality within the nationality laws, as well as how they're going to protect children in Malaysia.
Amal, you mentioned earlier that immigration and or even security was often cited by countries as their concern for not doing more. In reading about this case, it seems like the fear of the slippery slope of traffickers and adoption rings or even non-nationals who are in the country, undocumented, asking for children who would require nationality by birth. What would you say to those two concerns?
So the state has an obligation and a responsibility to crack down on crime and to prevent crime. And this must be done in a manner which does not unreasonably infringe on civil liberties and the basic rights of residents in the country, citizens and non-citizens. And I think that if you look at the general practices around the world, it is possible to strike this balance. It is possible to be strong on crime while also being strong on rights. In fact, the two are completely compatible, because the more crime there is, the more people's rights are violated in various ways. So with all of this, if we look at another issue and you look at the whole war on terror, for example, you see terrorism being used as a justification to crack down on civil liberties. And you see then the pushback from society at large in terms of this is not the society that we are trying to preserve. And so the government of any country has this difficult role to play, and it is a difficult role of ensuring that people are safe, ensuring that people are protected, but also ensuring that people are free. There's no point being safe in a jail. And so we need to challenge governments, and I'm not Malaysian, so I cannot speak on behalf of Malaysian society, but on behalf, as a Sri Lankan, I would speak on behalf of my people, and in terms of wherever you see human rights challenges in the world, I think it's a duty of citizens and non-citizens alike to hold those who have the responsibility of legislating and executing laws to a very high standard. And that high standard requires looking at issues and approaching them in a reasoned and rational manner and in a principled manner. And I think the balance can be struck. In terms of your second question about stateless children being born in Malaysia, both of whose parents are not Malaysian, if I understand your question correctly. Here the legal principle is very clear. So the Convention on the Rights of the Child, which Sharmina spoke of, sets out that every child has a right to a nationality and that states have an obligation to ensure that children can enjoy that nationality, that right, particularly if they would otherwise be stateless. Now, this is the provision that, as Sharmila mentioned, Malaysia has entered a reservation into. And so maybe that's a reflection of the fact that there needs to be more of a social discourse on this problem. But at the very least, even if Malaysia is not prepared to grant nationality to stateless children born in the country, it has to be prepared to ensure that the lack of a nationality doesn't in any way undermine the other rights of the child, which means the child has to have equal access to health care, to education, to a future. And I think you will see when you go down that path that it doesn't make sense to withhold nationality from a child who does not have a connection with another state, who does not have another home, because you are basically telling a human being that after a certain point, you are unrooted, you have nowhere to go, and you're out there to kind of fend for yourself and do this on your own. And that completely undermines the very notion of society. And if we look at the stateless figures in the world, we're talking about around 15 million people globally, which is a tiny, tiny percentage of the global population. So it's not a big problem. It's not a problem that cannot be addressed effectively and absorbed by states. So I just think that we need to hold our leaders to a higher standard and expect more of them.
Sorry, if I can just add on to what Amal was saying, what you end up doing really is creating a subterranean society, because if these people cannot join your normal society by virtue of not being Malaysian, they do not belong to any other society because they're not an expat. There is no other country or no other home they can go to. So what you end up doing is they start coming together and forming a separate society, which is often a subterranean society because of the impediments to being above ground like the rest of us. And that in itself is a security risk, or can pose a security risk, because if we do not give them a means to, for example, join the formal workforce, then they are going to join the informal workforce. They are going to be a target for people who want to cause security risk either in Malaysia or to use them elsewhere in the world. And when people do not have the same access to whatever it is, like healthcare, you know, the fundamental needs of a human being, access to healthcare, access to education, access to justice, then they will find a home wherever someone gives them a home. And that could be in the the communities that we may not actually want them to go into.
So I read that at the conclusion of the consultation, a citizenship task force will be formed. What happens next? Maybe I'll start with Amal, how the consultation ended. What can we anticipate seeing going forward? And Sharmila, maybe to summarize the recommendations that will be put forth to the government. Maybe I'll start with you, Amal.
Yeah, so the consultations, it was a very rich discussion over 2 days, and it ended with the publication of a statement which includes within it 13 recommendations to the state. And these are recommendations which cover many of the issues that we spoke of, but like you said, Sharmila, we'll go into that in more detail. In terms of the task force, this is a Malaysian civil society initiative to pull together and to collectively ensure that Malaysia implements certain recommendations that have been made to it by UN committees and treaty bodies, that Malaysia follows through in terms of ensuring that its nationality law is not gender discriminatory and that children are not subjected to the risk of statelessness, or even if it's not statelessness, that they're not left in a situation where they do not have the nationality of their Malaysian parent. So it's very encouraging from an international perspective. We had a wonderful final session at the conference where Sharmila was in fact facilitating this discussion, and different participants were coming up with suggestions of various things that they could do individually and collectively. And it was so nice to see this coming together of civil society. And it doesn't always happen like that. I've been at meetings of this nature in different countries around the world. Sometimes you have a similar kind of energy and positive feeling in the room, but sometimes that's not the case. So it was wonderful to see that. And I can say, I've been to Malaysia before on civil society work as well. Y'all are very lucky. Y'all have a very strong civil society, a very rights-oriented civil society, and some wonderful organizations and individuals. And to see them coming together around this issue, which is a central issue, as you said, which goes to the central notions of equal citizenship and child rights. So I feel very positive about where we are now and where we can go. And with civil society pressure, with wonderful attention from the media such as BFM, and hopefully with an impetus for change also with the changing political context in the country, we may achieve, Malaysia may change its laws so that there are only 24 countries that are gender discriminatory.
Sharmila, all parties were unanimous in their recommendations to the government?
Absolutely. So the delegates to the national consultation comprised of individuals, affected persons, concerned individuals, affected persons, civil society organizations. And like I said, we brought in people from Sabah and Sarawak as well. So it was very, very inclusive in terms of Malaysia-wide. So it's not a case of Putrajaya or Peninsular Malaysia dictating things to Sabah and Sarawak, because Sabah and Sarawak were here in considerable numbers and were very, very vocal and in themselves came up with ideas of what they could do in Sabah and Sarawak alone. So they're going off, and I think, if I'm not mistaken, within a month, or was it 3 months, they're going to be organizing a similar consultation for Sarawak and similarly for Sabah. So that is fantastic. But all the recommendations, yes, came, as Amal was saying, came from the floor and over the 2 days of consultation and hearing what each other had to say, came about from the Malaysian delegates. And in a sense, we can break them up into three categories. So the first category is the fact that we would like Pakatan Harapan to honour their commitment, in particular the special commitment to women, which in Commitment 4 has promised to review all laws relating to gender equality and to ensure that every woman enjoys legal equality, and also to amend the necessary laws. We have identified the federal constitution, in particular Article 14 and the schedule related to it, as well as Article 15, to bring it in line with Article 8, the non-discrimination against gender part of Article 8. But we have suggested that pending constitutional amendment, that the constitution need to be interpreted in the right way. And this is what I was explaining just now, that the constitution needs to be interpreted, and this is what is being done in all countries that have constitutional have a constitution, a federal constitution of their own. It needs to be interpreted in a generous and purposive manner and not in a literal, narrow manner. So we need to interpret our constitution generously and purposively, giving full measure to Article 8 of the federal constitution and bearing in mind the values and fundamental liberties which the constitution had intended to be embodied in it. We also then looked at Malaysia's reservations in terms of its international obligation, in particular CEDAW Article 9 and CRC Article 7, and perhaps for Malaysia to withdraw those articles as being in complete conflict with our federal constitution and Pakatan's commitment to women, special commitment to women. We then looked at very specific scenarios where there is, on the ground, discrimination and how it works out. So, for example, and where children, for example, are at risk, situations where, for example, children who are adopted by Malaysians cannot automatically obtain citizenship from their adopted Malaysian parents. They have to go through the process of applying for citizenship, which does not make sense. So that in itself is in conflict with the constitution and the adoption laws. But also in terms of giving parallel permanent residency or citizenship to stepchildren of Malaysians, where a Malaysian marries a foreign spouse and the foreign spouse obtains permanent residency or citizenship, then so as not to break up that family, to grant whatever the foreign spouse has, whether it's PR or citizenship, to grant the similar right to the child of the foreign spouse. So we looked at other issues like that. And then one of the big asks in terms of the recommendations, which we think is really, really fundamental to change in terms of the Pakatan government and the way it operates, is the need to cease all arbitrary and discriminatory practices which link gender, ethnicity, and religion with citizenship. So we've heard from Sabah, for example, that there is a link of these three, gender, ethnicity, and or religion with citizenship, and it is the officer on the ground who determines whether or not you get citizenship based on gender, ethnicity, and race, and how it appears on your birth registration documents or your IC. So that needs to stop. We need very clear, transparent rules, guidelines, SOPs relating to the granting of permanent residency and citizenship applications involving foreign spouses, parents, and their children born abroad. And the procedures should respect the federal constitution, international law, rules of due process. They need to set out reasonable time frames for decisions to be made. We need very, very much, we need to establish an independent complaints and appeal mechanism, because what we heard over and over again over the 2 days from affected persons and organizations working on the ground with affected persons is that citizenship is so arbitrary. You can wait for 4 years. You can put in an application and wait for 4 years only to find that your application has not been rejected. You've just not been successful. So there's no outright rejection. So you need to then find out why it was not successful and make the necessary amendment. And then you go back to the bottom of the line or bottom of the pile and you work your way up. And that takes another 4 years, say, for example. And again, because of some internal change in policy, which is secret, it's not made known to people, you find that it's, again, not successful. And then you have to go and find out why. And they say, oh, because you're missing a particular document. And this document was never asked for in the beginning. So, you know, it's this kind of thing which is very, very random, very arbitrary, and not at all transparent. So we need to stop this. We need to make sure that when someone goes to apply, whether it's for PR or for citizenship, it's very clear what they need to do to be on the path towards obtaining it. And the law is clear. You grant citizenship to people, for example, foreign spouses. Article 14 is very clear that foreign spouses, foreign wives, can get citizenship by virtue of residency for 2 years, not PR, but being present in the country, residency for 2 years, and being of good character. But what does good character mean? What do they need to produce? What documents do they need to produce? Do they need a letter from the embassy? What is it? How do we determine someone's good character? We need to make things like this clear so that it is not a little Napoleon making decisions by him or herself, waking up in the morning, making one decision today and a different decision tomorrow. We also have suggested and recommended that we establish a tripartite oversight committee comprising of people from the government, people from opposition, and civil society to ensure the implementation of these recommendations and hopefully to be able to guarantee the timely realization of gender equal nationality rights in accordance with the federal constitution and our international obligations.
Were any members of parliament or the Pakatan Harapan government on hand to receive these recommendations?
So they were invited, but of course parliament is in session now, so in that sense the timing was not too good. I have to say that this consultation was planned much before the elections were called, or you know, the government came into being. So the timing could not be helped. Unfortunately, you know, Parliament was in session, so none of them could attend. But we did have people from the government, officers, in particular from the Ministry of Women, were present. Some of us who were involved in the consultation attended Parliament and we did a briefing for some of the MPs. So YB Hannah Yeo, who is the Deputy Minister in the Ministry of Women, Family and Community Development, was there and she received our briefing along with YB Maria Chin, YB Fami Fadzil, and a few other members of Parliament. We also managed to speak to some of the opposition parliamentarians, including the leader of the opposition. So we're very, very hopeful that our recommendations will be taken forward, will be considered seriously. Perhaps what needs to happen in terms of the government, in terms of parliament, perhaps what they need to do is to quickly set up a steering committee to address not just this issue, but the issue of citizenship generally and statelessness. And we hope that these issues, which really a lot of these issues are low-hanging fruit, so they can be addressed very, very quickly by political will, by administrative means. We do not need legal reform for all of our recommendations.
And we'll be following this issue closely. Sharmila Amal, thank you very much for taking the time.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Live and Learn, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.